Chapter 22. Hesho and I appeared in the cafeteria, but I judged things wrong. Dinner was already over, and a group of rookie ground troops were busy wiping down the tables. A few looked at me and jumped. The old me would have appreciated the fearsome reputation I'd cultivated. Today, the panic of having missed the others was far more potent. Hesho hovered up beside my head, then turned a masked face toward me, seeming confused.
"We're not too late," he said. "Look, they have some of the latecomer meals."
He pointed to the sandwiches prepared for those with irregular shifts. I grabbed two because I was starving and wanted enough to share with Hesho, but this wasn't actually why we'd come. I had to find the others. A part of me realized that my sudden urgency was silly. There would be more times to chat with my friends. But I'd noticed a welling up need, a solution to my own anxiety that had to be filled. I wanted to see them. Chet wanted to see them. Both of us needed this, right now. And I'd missed the chance to be part of what was normally one of the most... Wait. It was Thursday. I waved to Hesho, then turned down the hallway. Not hyper-jumping, but moving at a brisk, almost run toward the hangar bays. I pushed open the door, then let out a relieved sigh. They were here. Thursday was our flight's time in the hangar for maintenance, which was something of a misnomer since the ground crews did most of the difficult work. They replaced parts and ran detailed diagnostics. That left the pilots to do our pre-flight checklist each time we went into the air and what we did on Thursdays, wash the ships. It was more ritual than requirement. We rarely flew in atmosphere anymore, and the ships didn't get as dirty as they once had. But there was a bond between a pilot and her ship, and it helped to actively care for it. So once a week, we came in here to give the ships a bath and a polish. As was tradition, everyone had gathered around one of the ships to work on it together. At the moment, wearing somewhat soggy, dark green maintenance jumpsuits, they were working on Arturo's Poco, wiping char off the sides near the boosters, scrubbing the white panels until they shone, giving the canopy a good polish. As soon as I burst in, Kimmelin turned, then grinned widely and waved to me. I hesitantly made my way forward. I knew I shouldn't feel awkward rejoining them. I'd helped forge this team. But things had been off ever since I'd come back, with my soul trying to rip out of my body and my powers being strange and... Thwack. A wet towel hit me in the face as Ned trotted by. It peeled off and fell into my hands. Wait, Ned was here? Out of the infirmary? He looked pretty good, all things considered, with one sleeve sewn up just above the elbow. He glanced at that, following my sightline, then winked.
"Best excuse I've ever had to take a nap while Arturo works," he said. "Too bad the medics say they'll get me a prosthetic arm with fingers that can move. I've got to milk this for every ounce of sympathy I can before I become Cyborg Ned."
A prosthetic arm? We'd assumed his flying career was finished, as our technology wasn't particularly advanced in the realm of cybernetics. But maybe it was better than I thought. Perhaps my failure wasn't as costly as I'd feared. It was still my fault that he'd been hurt. I tried to force out the words.
"Come on," he said, cutting me off. "We saved the messiest part for you."
He grinned, then thumbed toward the ship's landing skids.
"Ned," Arturo called. "She hasn't come to a single one of these since she got back. We didn't save anything for her."
"Sure we did," Ned called back. "We saved them for me, and by tradition, I waited for a way to make someone else do them."
He put his good arm out and grinned while giving me a side hug. And, well, everything wasn't all right. Things were still strange. But I no longer felt like leaving.
"You should know better than to give me a dangerous weapon, Ned," I said to him, twisting the towel. "Scud no," he said, dodging out of the way as I tried to whip it at him. "You're the best one to hold the dangerous weapon. Then people aim at you instead of me and we're all happy."
He ambled back toward the ship, and I started after him, then glanced at Hesho,
who sat straight upright in his seat in the little hover disc. He had his white and red mask on, so I couldn't see his expression, but from his prim posture and tightly gripped fists, he seemed alarmed. He'd seen how we treated each other before, but I guessed maybe he found this even more extreme. "This is normal," I said to him, wolfing down a sandwich.
"It is."
"Yep. Trust me. This is good." He hovered beside me as I finished the sandwich and knelt to begin cleaning the landing gear. And despite what Ned had said earlier, he got down with me and joined in, working with his good arm. Sadie, grinning, flipped down underneath the front of the ship, then hung just above us from a belt that she'd wrapped around the nose and began polishing. "Sadie," I asked, "did you strap yourself in so you could clean upside down?"
"So much easier this way," she said. "Don't have to crane your neck."
"I'd fall asleep," Ned said from beside me. "Too much like a hammock."
"Oh?" Kimmelin replied, ducking down to look at us.
"Are you implying that you need to be comfortable to take a nap, Ned? I've got you sleeping in the most ridiculous positions." "See? That's the thing," he said. "Once you fall asleep, you don't notice anymore."
"'Cause you're unconscious."
"So, sleeping when you're uncomfortable is really the best way to approach life."
"And sleeping when you're comfortable?" I asked.
"Also the best way to approach life," he said.
"Bless your stars," Kimmelin said.
"Nah, but you can bless my snores," he said, grinning as he dug harder into the caked-on gunk on the landing gear.
Hesho hovered a little closer and picked his own section, some gears that were too tight for us to reach into, and cleaned there with a very small rag. "You all know my friend, Mask?" I said.
"Yep," Ned said.
"I must admit," Hesho said to them, "I am not accustomed to interactions of this sort. Please don't mistake my stiffness for dislike."
"That's right," Ned said, wagging his rag at Hesho. "Mask, I heard you were someone real important before."
I was," Hesho said. "But I don't know if we should discuss."
I gave Ned a glance, but he winked at me.
"I heard," he continued, "you were a babysitter."
"Yeah," Sadie said. "Like, you had to wrangle preschoolers. An entire country's worth of them."
"Seems like it would be a relief not to have to deal with that sort of thing anymore," Ned said, still working. "I feel for you, my friend. When did you ever get to take a nap?"
Hesho paused, then seemed amused as he responded.
"Well, I shall say I did not get to take many. It was quite the project, wrangling all those preschoolers. I often didn't even have time for meditation or composing poetry."
Ned gasped.
"No poetry?"
"You compose poetry, Nedder?" Hesho asked.
"I love the stuff," Ned said. "You do not compose poetry," Arturo said, walking past. "Forgive him," Ned said. "His wit's as thick as a Tewksbury mustard."
"As what?" I asked.
"It's Shakespeare," Ned said.
Nearby, Arturo froze. He pulled out his datapad and looked through it, then looked back at Ned, his jaw dropping.
"It is Shakespeare, from Henry IV.
"A most notable coward," Ned said, thumbing toward Arturo. "An infinite and endless liar, an hourly promise breaker, the owner of no one good quality."
"Man, that dude had the best insults. I love them."
"Who is this again?" I asked.
"Ancient English dude," Ned said. "Wrote poetry. A lot of it survived the destruction of the Defiant and our records. You'd like him, Spin. Surprised your grandma didn't tell you stories about him. You know, Hamlet and crud like that."
"Hamlet," I said.
"It is the single most famous work of human literature," Hesho replied. "Even I have studied it. And I find, Nedder, your taste in insults to be exceptional. You are obviously a man of great refinement.
See, Arturo? Ned said. The preschool teacher agrees with me.
He gave Hesho a wide grin. Nearby, Arturo was still staring, slack-jawed, as if he'd found out that his mother had secretly been a ninja all his life.
You, he said, have memorized quotes from Shakespeare.
Forgive Amphi, Ned said, leaning closer to Hesho. He's a little on the slow side sometimes. We try to be accommodating.
Oh, scud, Arturo said, stalking off to join Alanique,
who was preparing more buckets and soap for the next ship in line. Hesho seemed to understand it was teasing, though. He was nodding behind his formal mask and looked relaxed. FM was moving up beneath the ship, polishing as she went. I realized then that everyone was soaking, except her. Somehow she always avoided getting hit, while I, if present, generally ended up the most wet. Naturally, I always took someone down with me.
Hey, Mask, FM said. Your people used to visit ours, right? Long ago? I've talked to Juno about it.
The Lore Keeper? Hesho asked. How do you know him?
He and Jorgen hang out a lot, FM said.
I wasn't aware that Juno hung out as a general rule, Hesho said.
Well, he calls it training, but I think they just like to chat, FM said. He was really helpful when Jorgen trained to cut things in half with his mind.
As one does, Ned said.
I wish I could cut things in half with my mind, Sadie said, still hanging upside down. It would make it so much easier to get my rations open. Why do they seal the field rations so tight?
I doubt Jorgen uses his powers for such mundane things, Sentry, Kimmelin said. I didn't contradict her.
Anyway, Mask, FM said, I've been thinking. You've been flying with Spencer, right?
It is my privilege to join her in the cockpit, he answered. And I believe I've been of service, helping her navigate and monitor controls while in combat.
And Jorgen flew with Juno, FM said. Juno helped him learn to meditate.
Jorgen learned meditation, I said, while in battle? I hadn't heard that part.
Basically, yeah, FM said.
She squatted down beside where Hesho, Ned, and I worked.
I've been looking at schematics. We build our ships the size we do for a reason. They're optimized, just big enough to maintain maneuverability and to carry large enough guns for damage.
Indeed, Hesho said. When we started building our own starships, we initially began with much smaller designs, scaled to our size. However, we found that they lacked the necessary firepower to be meaningful on the galactic stage. We eventually settled on designs not much different in size from your own.
Many species have ended up with the same sizes of ships, she said, excited.
Scud.
You've been thinking the same thing I have, I said, pointing to her.
Furry co-pilots? She asked.
Furry co-pilots.
What?
Ned asked. Most of the ships we build are one-person vessels, FM explained. Two-seaters sacrifice speed for the extra bulk, so we don't generally use them as interceptors. But having a co-pilot is probably super useful.
It is, I said.
Part of the reason I was so good when flying M'Bot's old ship was that he could take over some of the duties for me, monitoring proximity, giving me a heads up on ships coming our way. It's been incredibly useful to have Hesho doing the same duties.
Yes, Hesho said softly. Having a second pilot who does not take up much space and can be fit into a normal cockpit without modifications is a huge advantage to Spencer and me.
Exactly, FM said. Do you think any of the others in your fleet would be interested in trying it out?
I know many who would love to do so, Hesho said. Our officer training involves a lot of redundant positions on various stations. We have junior staff who are eager for combatant status, but who rarely get a chance. I think If you were to approach the proper heads of the military and state, this idea would eagerly be accepted.
Heads of state, eh?
Ned said, whacking the now-clean landing gear with his rag.
Scud, it felt so wonderful to see him again, and for him to be taking his injury in stride. But what else had I expected from Ned?
Hey, Spin, what position in line do you think I am for head of our government?
None, I said flatly. You are not in line.
Sure I am, Ned said. The DDF isn't actually that large. What are we, 6,000 people? And now the military is in direct command. I'm a lieutenant, so...
Oh, Scud. He was right. I'd never really thought of it, but technically Ned was in the chain of command. Kimmelin grabbed her datapad with a mischievous grin.
One admiral of the fleet, 4 vice admirals, currently 9 rear admirals, captains, commanders, lieutenant commanders. Let's assume every lieutenant is ahead of Ned.
Well, FM said, still squatting nearby, what is the horrible verdict?
117th, she admitted, in line for command of the DDF, which, until we organize another national assembly, is the de facto ruling body of the planet.
In my government, you'd be the equivalent of a senatorial body head, Netter, Hesho offered. A very senior and distinguished position, fit for a master poet such as yourself.
Hell yeah, he said.
Saint help us if it came to that, Arturo said.
You'd be dead, Kimmelin said, since you're ahead of him in the line of succession.
Well, you'd have that going for you at least, Alanique said, giving Ned a smile and setting down a fresh bucket of soapy water for him.
I'll beat thee, Ned quoted, hand to his chest, but I would infect my hands.
I glanced at Hesho, who still hovered next to the group of us underneath the front fuselage of the ship. How was he taking this? He looked from Ned to the others, then, remarkably, took off his mask and set it beside him. A grin marked his snout as he leaned forward.
"'Twas not a friend, and not a foe, who did besmirch thee, but merely a foul wind, not worthy of retort."
"Oh," Ned said. "I don't know that one."
"It's from one of our poets," Hesho said. "My great-great-great-grandfather was a playwright, and fond of insults."
Scud, Ned said. A Kitson Shakespeare? Can I read his stuff?
It would be my greatest honor to share it with you. Then you will have an entirely new repertoire of poetic deprecations at your disposal.
Awesome, Ned said, raising his fist to Hesho. Fight the man.
The man? Hesho asked.
Him, mostly, Ned said, indicating Arturo. Except when he pays for snacks. Then he's not the man, he's the man.
The intricacies of your language are indeed intriguing, Hesho said. Do you know of any other human poets that I should investigate?
Unfortunately, our archives are super fragmented, Ned said. But there was this legendary poet named David Bowie, who may or may not have actually been real.
The two continued chatting as I stepped away from the ship and stretched. Feeling thirsty, I wandered over to the water station, and Kimmelin joined me a moment later.
"Did you bring Hesho?" she said, "just to try to get him to open up to us?"
I nodded, surprised she'd been able to read me that well. "You all got through to me," I said. "I figured Hesho can't be that much harder."
"That was compassionate of you, Spin," Kimmelin said. "Hesho must feel so much loss, being cast from his position as he was."
"He wasn't cast from it," I explained, watching Hesho speak animatedly to Ned and the others. "He chose, but it's still hard on him. I thought maybe he needed some more friends."
"Smart," Kimmelin said.
then looked at me, thoughtfully. "You're going to remind me, yet again, that you're here for me if I need you," I said, "right?"
"Damn straight," she said, squeezing my arm. "I heard you took a plan to Jorgen. You wanted to attack right now?"
I nodded. "But we're not going to," Kimmelin said. I shook my head.
"How are you doing with that?"
"Strangely fine," I said, meeting her brown eyes. "I talked to Hesho earlier and, well, I think I'm going to be all right letting Jorgen lead."
Kimmelin smiled. She didn't head back to the others immediately, though. She leaned against the water station, giving me space by not demanding more answers, but also staying near. Though I hadn't made any conscious decisions, I felt as if the matter was resolved. I wasn't going to run off on my own this time. Hesho was right. More profoundly, this team was right. Felt right. This was my home. I'd been away for too long, but being here, watching my friends laugh, knowing they were watching out for me, I felt a warmth that was in direct contrast to the strange feelings of loss I'd been experiencing. Like light in a cavern beating back the darkness, their presence changed me. Us. Chet felt it too. For my whole life, I'd believed I just needed to fly. That was what I'd hunted, what had driven me. But in the end, that wasn't what actually mattered most. I gave Kimmelin a smile. "Things are coming together for me. Finally. Thank you for being patient. For now, what if we went and invited Shiver and Liz to join us? I bet they're feeling out of place and lonely, too. They're pilots, and being around ships and people working on them might be comforting." Kimmelin grinned, and so we told the others, then went to check on the two resonants. They'd been assigned quarters nearby, and after knocking and getting permission, we entered to find the two crystalline beings sitting in chairs. The rooms weren't furnished with much, but I doubted that mattered to the resonants. More tellingly, though, their crystals hadn't expanded far. They'd barely grown around the chairs, which indicated to me that they weren't comfortable here.
"Spin," Shiver said. "I was hoping you'd come. Deliz is getting even better."
Deliz sent me images I couldn't quite parse. Empty caverns, a lonely crystal, but a rising sun as well, sparkling through a tunnel full of different kinds of crystals. I took it in and thought maybe it meant she was happy. But still, there was the impression that she was also missing something. "We were just wondering if you two wanted to come see some of our starfighters," I said to them. "We're doing maintenance on them now, and I figured it would be a good time."
"Really?" Shiver asked. "You'd let us? We're aliens. Former pirates, Spin. Surely we don't belong."
"You'd be surprised," Kimmelin said with a warm smile. "We've lived our entire lives short-staffed. If you can fly and are willing, you're welcome. If you want, I can even talk to Command about getting you commissions."
"No need to commit to something like that," I said quickly. "The offer to take you home to your caverns once this is over still stands. We can probably hyperjump you there." I got hit with an immediate set of visualizations from Deliz. The sky, the wind, the fragments of the nowhere, soaring. It was self-explanatory. Once you'd had that, going back to a few caverns wasn't an option. Scud, how had I ever thought otherwise? After a quick call to Command for permission, we brought the two resonants to join the others. And interestingly, it was Hesho who spoke to them first, welcoming them in as Ned had welcomed him. They would fit right into the flight, I was certain. I'd push for it, as I had this feeling that the more different types of people we got into the flight, the stronger it would be. I watched them for a moment, but there was one more thing to do. As I realized earlier, I wanted my friends to help build Embot's new body. They would love it, and the activity would give us a further chance to bond with Hesho and the Resonance. I vanished and reappeared in the cavern, startling Doomslug, who had wanted to stay when we'd left. She fluted at me from where she'd snuggled in on the table, seeming content and happy there. The Tanix might have enjoyed being with us humans, but for them, these musty caverns felt like home. And that was just fine. I gave her a scritch on the head and along her flutes before putting my hands on my hips and looking at the mess Hesho and I had made of these parts. I'd have to pile them all up, then hyperjump them back up into the hangar. Or maybe it would just be easier to bring everyone down here? Seeing it all there, unfortunately, gave me a moment of panic. It reminded me of when I'd discovered M'Bot torn apart on Starsight, and the feelings of panic and sorrow I'd felt at losing him. I was struck by a disorientation, and the air started to warp around me. A metal cup from the hangar, the one I'd been drinking out of, dropped out of midair and clanged to the ground. Fighting the episode down was easier this time. The effects of having been around the others lingered with me, and I was proud of how well I handled the sudden panic. Indeed, everything seemed fine. Right up until the moment Doomslug fluted in alarm. A second later, something hit me from behind. An electric bolt of energy that coursed through my body, leaving me weak and trembling as I dropped to the hard stone. Doomslug's fluting trailed off abruptly. A new panic arose in me. What was happening? I tried to move, but I'd been stunned, my muscles flexing and unflexing uncontrollably. I even started drooling. Though my eyes worked fine, and so I could see clearly when someone grabbed me by the shoulder and turned me over. Braid. Wearing black combat gear and a flak jacket, backed up by 5 soldiers in similar gear, holding assault rifles.
Good, Braid said. It's her.
One of the others was holding a limp Doomslug in their arms. I tried to struggle, froth bubbling at my lips. If they had hurt her... Braid looked up as the air warped again. Something crashed to the ground nearby, and pieces of the table vanished. Then, oddly, she smiled.
Leave the note, she said to one of the soldiers. You! Squeeze that slug!
He squeezed Doomslug, and I panicked further. The air warped again, and only then did I realize what Braid was doing. When I broke the air apart in my wave of panic, it had opened a path through our inhibitors, which had let her slip in. And not just in my mind this time. She was physically here. And by hurting Doomslug, they were making me panic more, which opened a pathway for them to escape. I tried to clamp down on it, but I was too slow. Braid hauled me up and over her shoulder. Then the other soldiers each put a hand on her arm. A second later, we hyperjumped away, and I felt a sudden spike of dread. Not just because I was now in enemy hands, but because I knew what everyone was going to think. They'd assume that I had gone off on my own again. I wasn't merely in serious danger. I'd likely just broken the hearts of Jorgen and my other friends yet again.